Welcome to the booksite.net. I'm Mark Strassman, the host and producer, and we're in the Los Angeles Central Library today talking to John Nathan, who's just written Sony, The Private Life. Welcome to the booksite.net.
Mark, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Why don't we start by you giving our listeners a little bit of your own background and tie it into why you were motivated and positioned to write this particular book.
Okay. Actually, I've been a student of Japan probably for close to 40 years. I don't want to give you the long-playing version of this, but the fact of the matter is I first went to Japan in 1961, having graduated with a degree in Japanese studies at Harvard, went to the University of Tokyo, began to write and translate. I've translated a lot of Japanese literature by Yukio Mishima and Kenzaburo Oe and others, made a number of movies in Japan, and in that capacity was recently, three and a half years ago, commissioned by Sony to make a film about them to commemorate their 50th anniversary, which took place in 1996.
And what's the relationship between this book and that film?
Well, in the course of interviewing Sony executives in Tokyo and around the world, it became apparent to me that there was a larger, darker, more turbulent, and indeed interesting story beneath the surface of all the sort of success, congratulatory stuff that I was being told in the course of making this film. So I decided to go back, having finished the film, and solicit Sony's permission to actually get inside deeply and to write a book, a serious book about Sony's history.
One of the biggest and most important questions, I think, now confronting us at a lot of different levels is either the conflict or at least the relationship between technology and humanity. And the book that you've written here, Sony, the Private Life, doesn't have a lot of numbers in it, and it has very little in the way of how Betamax works and what's a mini disc player and so on. It's about relationships. What are you trying to illuminate about the relationship between technology and humanity in this book?
Well, I wasn't, I must confess, consciously setting out to address that particular relationship, although it's a very valuable and important one. I think there's a lot of implicit connection in the book. For example, this is a biography-driven story, in which I go deeply into the main characters who built the empire, the Sony empire. The current chairman of Sony, I think, is a terrific example of somebody who bridges remarkably these two worlds. He's a musician, a conductor, an operatic baritone trained in Tokyo and in Berlin, who wanted to pursue a career as a performing musician, and who decided when Morita persuaded him to abandon that because he also had a huge capacity for technological understanding and entered Sony. And he then took over a huge responsibility inside the organization and was in fact the person who spearheaded the CD, which Sony released in the early 90s in collaboration with Philips in Holland. Now, this is a man who is on the one hand an artist, on the other a guy who loves and deeply understands how technology works and is also a very savvy businessman. So when you talk to him, I once asked him, how do you somehow reconcile Beethoven's string quartets on the one hand and junction lasers driving CDs on the other? And his answer to me was not really entirely satisfactory, but he said, well, I just have a number of, I have switches in my body, and I don't try to make the connection. Beethoven will always be Beethoven for me, and the CD enables me to enjoy Beethoven in a better form than I could do any other way. So there is a connection in my mind, but basically I'm two different people when I'm dealing with technology on the one hand and art on the other.
It's very interesting. I think there's going to be a parallel that will give us some insight into some other issues from that also. Bridging is one of the key issues in this whole book, essentially bridging the Japanese and American cultures. And what you just said was that this particular person has sort of resolved that dilemma by saying that they're separate, that never the twain. Right.
Yes, Norio Oga, the current chairman of the company, right.
In your discussion in the talk you just gave about Akio Morita and his bridging Western and Japanese modes of being, the idea sort of is that he has two modes also, a Japanese mode and an American mode. Well, say something about that and give us a little bit of the historical background of how he came to be in a position to be that bridge.
Well, first of all, I think every post-war Japanese carries around inside himself or herself this kind of tension between the native sensibility and customs and social behaviors that are inherent and born with, on the one hand, and the kind of Western modes of being in the world that are learned on the other. And reconciling those two different worlds is one of the major challenges, it seems to me, of modern Japanese life. In Morita's case, I mean, he came from a very traditional Japanese family, a 300-year-old family business, sake brewers. And interestingly, his forebears were, in addition to being affluent merchants in their neighborhood, were also what I might call ombudsmen. That is to say, they were expected to be kind of amateur mayors who had considerable authority, to whom people came when they had problems. So that Moita learned from the time he was a tiny boy a lot about both business behavior and people interactive skills, which his father passed on to him because it was expected he was going to take over this ombudsman-like role as the head of the family.
So in a way, even though he exercised some of these functions in a Western context, the deep perceptions and self-images necessary to operate that way came to him within Japanese culture.
That's I think you're very perceptive to observe that. Yes, I mean, on the one hand, he had a set of Japanese skills, if I might call them that, which helped him and served him extremely well as he curried favor and won friendship and used his connections to in Sony's behalf. But, of course, those skills had to be translated by him. Here the bridge notion that you suggest comes into play in order to be applicable to the kinds of particular exigencies created by American society and the way in which Americans think and work. And that translation process was something that he was extremely good at doing, but at considerable cost to himself.
We'll talk about the cost in a minute. Let's talk about his abilities and skills. He is apparently a prodigious socializer. At a deep as well as a superficial level.
That's of course true. Yes, I mean he had a great hunger for acceptance into elite areas in society, both in Japan and the United States and Europe, and he was able to, in fact, win the friendship and the confidence of a lot of very powerful and influential people who saw him as someone who, as Japanese uniquely, they could actually understand and have a conversation with. And I just want to say that although I talk a lot about Morita being a performer and wearing a mask and so on, the fact remains that he was the principal post-war Japanese businessman, certainly, who communicated to people like Henry Kissinger and David Rockefeller and all the rest at least the possibility of genuine communication. And that possibility, I think, may live on as one of his most important legacies.
Hegel described the world historical individual as a person who essentially resolves within himself the contradictions of his age and by successfully doing so achieves his greatness. To the extent that one of the questions of our age is America's relationship to Japan and the rest of the non-American world, how close does Akio Morita come to fitting that description?
Well, I'm not sure that he comes as close as he would like to have, because I don't think he really manages to resolve in the Hegelian sense. Certainly, I don't think Hegel would have thought that he had resolved, quote-unquote. I mean, in Hegel, of course, we're dealing with the whole dialectic process, a little different with Aufheben elements and other things involved, right?
I'll leave the Aufheben elements to you.
Okay. For now. Well, I'll leave them to you, actually. But in any event, I would have a little trouble, you know, applying that definition to Morita whole.
So you say he may have been a world individual wannabe.
A world individual wannabe. That's probably a better way of putting it. Yes.
Okay. Why don't we talk about some of his operational methods and some of the story of Sony and Morita in the U.S. Just as it was apparent to me, you made it explicit in the book that from his earliest days in New York, he worked very closely with a lot of members of the Jewish community. What was that particular relationship, if there was one?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It happened at first circumstantially that the first Americans that Morita actually met and who helped him were downtown Lower East Side American Jews. In particular, a guy named Rudolph Gross, who was a cigar-chomping, Runyon-esque business guy with a lot of scams and angles, who took Morita on when he was a young man in the late 50s and sort of taught him American angleism from the point of view of Thompson Square. The other guy was, of course, Edward Rossini, who was also Jewish, who was his consigliere and who taught him a lot of and took him into the mysteries of litigation and other American legal procedure. Now, if you look at the history of Americans involved in Sony from that point on, you will find that every single important player was Jewish. And this is hardly—it seems possible to be a coincidence. I don't have hard evidence on this, but there are people who have vague memories of Morita having given lectures to young Sony Japanese going out to make their fortunes in America. That whenever possible, they should get into bed with do business with Jews in New York because there was people that they could trust and feel close to. So there's definitely something going on. At many points in the history of Sony America, the office was very, very Jewish. I mean, Japanese accountants were using Yiddish to refer to deposit slips and so on and so forth.
Is some of it sort of being a smart, driven outsider culture? Both Japanese in the U.S. and Jews in the U.S.?
Yes. I mean, there's something that can be construed as obliquely anti-Semitic about all of this, but putting that aside, because I think it's a distortion, In this case, I think it's definitely the sort of consciousness of being an outsider wherever one is, which is both a Jewish and a Japanese consciousness, of course. There is the kind of family, traditional emphasis on behavior and achievement. But I think the outsider element is a very important one. I mean, when Morita first saw Fiddler on the Roof, he fell totally in love with it, as did Ibuka, who left the Broadway theater saying, these people are just like us. And Morita, in fact, contrived to produce Fiddler on the Roof in Japan, actually brought it to Japan and made a huge hit out of it because he loved it so much. And I think there is an element of sort of cultural convergence.
And presumably people went to Maxim's afterwards, after they saw it, because he brought that to Japan also.
That's true. So you had the Jewish musical followed by some very good crepe, Suzette. Yeah.
Or blintzes, if you want to call them that.
At Maxim's, they charge much too much money if they call them blintzes.
After being tutored in the byways and folkways of American business by Jews in the Lower East Side, Morita eventually ends up involved with higher flying Jews here in Hollywood, who, did they take him for a ride?
Yes, I think in some respects they certainly did. I mean, he was a real sucker for the kind of spectacular that people like Peter Gruber could dish up to him, sensing very cleverly that he loved hanging out with the Hollywood glitterati and so on. I mentioned this afternoon that this purchase of Hollywood was something that Morita undertook, even though he knew it was full of pitfalls, because basically he decided he really wanted to own a studio. He also had some theoretical thinking about the importance of creating software to be used with Sony hardware, and that was an idea that he'd had way back, even before the advent of the CD. But yes, I believe that that Morita may have sometimes been manipulated. On the other hand, he was also a world-class manipulator in his own right, and so if you look at the story carefully enough, you'll see that he often was laying his own numbers on some of these boys who considered themselves the slickest guys in town.
So he couldn't claim amateur standing in any of this?
I don't think so, no.
Tell us something about his partner, Mr. Ibuka.
Ibuka was a very, very different sort of guy, the kind of guy who, when he went to the Italian club in Rome and the Italian luminaries were there, he when it was time to have the pasta dish, he asked for sugar because he liked the spaghetti with sugar on it, and he would take big spoonfuls and heap it on the spaghetti and then eat it by himself quickly, and then asked to be excused because he didn't drink and didn't want to hang around. In other words, he had absolutely no capacity at all to accommodate to social protocol, to the needs of others. He was a very sort of self-fixated guy who nonetheless was able to inspire engineers, all of whom worshipped him to great heights, and whose smile was the kind of reward that people would actually labor for months and months and months to be in the presence of. But he was a sort of an awkward, fixated, the kind of guy with big shoes who squeezes your hand too hard without looking at you in the face, and then goes on, spills soup on his tie, and gets right back into the laboratory.
So he was pretty much the inside guy, and Morita was kind of the outside guy.
100%, basically, I mean.
But tell us a little bit more about their working relationship.
Well, it was kind of a mysterious one. I actually, of course, never had the pleasure of watching it because both of them were ill and out of the picture by the time I started messing around or looking into the Sony story. But they had these adjoining rooms, which I've seen, which are preserved, where you actually see what they're like, with an internal door connecting them. And according to the secretaries, who were still there, keeping them exactly as they were, I mean, Ibuka was always in Morita's office. When Morita would make long phone calls in his awkward English to bring down a big deal, a joint venture with Texas, Ibuka would sit there sort of listening and nodding, and they dine together whenever they could. You know, they knew about, when they were very involved in one of those business. Ibuka had some scandalous stuff that went on around his family life that Morita and his wife got involved in helping keep out of the press. Ibuka would call out to his secretary, go inside of Morita's third-hand lower drawer, there's a screwdriver set, and I need that to fix my flashlight. Morita took care of Ibuka, was worried about him sort of being maladroit and vulnerable when he was outside the office, and assigned young men to follow him around all the time to make sure everything was all right. And more importantly, in terms of the business relationship, there was a kind of an esteem there, it seems, that was absolutely unflagging. In other words, if Ibuka thought something ought to be done, Morita would get it done, no matter what it took. And on the other hand, Ibuka always seconded. I mean, they spoke really with one voice in what seems to have been a legitimate and genuine way. I mean, they really were somehow symbiotically connected, these guys.
In a more general sense, there seem to be relationships going on within Sony that I'm not privy to the inner workings of major American corporations, but just the human relation level of motivation by pride and wanting to please people and so on. Money doesn't seem to come up. I'm sure there are power struggles, and then you recount them, but there seems to be a qualitatively distinct way of relating within Sony compared to, say, the way American corporate life works.
Well, one must be careful either not to generalize or to idealize, of course. It is, after all, a business. You have to remember, that, first of all, compensation alone. I mean, you know, the Japanese people work for salaries at the CEO and president level, which are fractions of what are made here, so that the whole drive just to achieve more money and power, and there are, of course, the stock options were against the law in Japan until last year. So the whole sort of executive connection to the bank, which is being filled by the company's success, is a very different one. So what does that leave? It leaves an identification with the organization's values, and it leaves sort of loyalty and connections to other people in the organization in order to win and achieve things, which is actually, in the long run, a much healthier way for people to relate, it seems to me, to their organization. So yes, I think it's possible, without being romantic, to conclude that, in fact, it's a more healthy relationship. Now, there are other things. There are downsides. I mean, the kind of feudal loyalty has puts corporate individuals into these positions where they kill themselves working and have no family life and so on and so forth. And actually, Ibuka and Morita were so engrossed in their business lives that their families really got short shrift in one way or another.
And when you say kill themselves working, isn't that what happened to both of them?
Well, it's not so clear that it happened to Ibuka. I mean, Ibuka had a long medical history and so on. In Morita's case, it does seem pretty clear that, he just stretched himself behind it. The people who were close to him had been worried for some time. He had had some dizziness and other things which had been undisclosed previously to his stroke. And basically, it was political ambition in his case rather than working for Sony. I mean, it was really in his role as emissary to the chairman of the Japanese Federation of Economic Organizations, the Keidanren, which had put this tremendous stress on him in the 2 years prior to his 1993 stroke.
And it's pretty likely that that led directly to the stroke.
Well, who
as much as anything.
Yeah, it seems it certainly wasn't good for him.
Mr. Ibuku has died,
yes.
but Mr. Morita is living in Hawaii, convalescing, or?
No, Mr. Morita passed away on Sunday.
That's 2 days ago, you mean?
2 days ago.
Well, I didn't know. And
I was called by an NPR person and had a long interview on Sunday afternoon. And I said, just out of curiosity, why today? And she said, you don't know that Mr. Morita died. So he died on Sunday morning.
How old was he?
He was 78.
Well, he made a tremendous, he accomplished a tremendous amount.
He certainly did, yeah.
And I'm sorry that he's died, and I'm glad you've told us about what he did while he was alive in Sony the Private Life.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you.